Hey, good morning, everybody. Yes, it's a good morning. No test today. So I have to lecture, but I have a microphone. That's okay. Make sure you sign the sign-in sheet, and let's figure out where we are in class. So let's look at the schedule on the right-hand side. And I'm going to turn a couple of these lights down. No, not that one. This one. Maybe like that. Something like that. Is that too dark? Nobody's complaining? Great. Okay, don't fall asleep because I can't tell. Because I can't see you. All right, so looking at the schedule, so today's April 1st, and we're going to finish up sensory, which is chapter 10, and maybe move into endocrinology today. And that will be good. Now, on April 3rd, that's a Thursday. Okay, as a matter of fact, our next class period is canceled. So you don't have to come to campus because I'm going to be over at the district office. I won't be at this campus. So I'm going to record a video lecture for you, and you have to then watch that video lecture. And maybe I'll have a bunch. Maybe I'll break up the lecture into maybe 10 pieces or 5 pieces. But nonetheless, that chapter still will be on your lecture exam. And I see a question.
So April 3rd, no campus meeting, no sign-in sheet.
No, yep, no sign-in sheet, no nothing. I think that's okay. I might get in trouble. There usually there is a sign-in sheet on the door, but since this is a hybrid class, I'm just going to replace your on-campus meeting with online work. So I think that will be okay. So no sign-in sheet either. Yeah. Oh, that's right. You guys still have lab on Thursday. Yeah, so if you have lab at 1 o'clock on Thursday or at 4:30 on Thursday, you still have to go. Yes, I forgot about lab. That's because I don't teach the lab, but you guys got to go. Yeah. That is the very next meeting. Yeah, April 3rd. Wow. Oh, I said April 10th? Yeah, April 3rd. Yeah, April 3rd. I pointed to it, right? I have no idea why it said April 10th. What, golly? You got me worried now. Why did I say April 10th? Maybe I got to go check. Ah, rats, I don't have time to check. Okay. This coming Thursday, April 3rd. Okay, I'll be over at the district, so I won't be here on campus, but you do have to go to labs that day. All right, so any questions regarding the schedule besides the one we just went over? No class next time for people that came in a little bit late. All right, so make sure that you can download videos. I've had videos, video lectures in Blackboard before for respiratory chapter, and so you got to make sure that you have the proper technology to look at those things. I will be on campus Thursday morning. If you have a question, we can work on that, but not late Thursday morning or Thursday afternoon. Yeah. The who? Oh, SI, it doesn't affect SI one way or the other. Right, so do we have any announcements from SI? Standard schedule for SI. Okay. All right, so what you can do is go to SI, go to the library, probably bring a headset with you, and listen to the lecture over in the library. Okay, and then go to your lab after that. I'm pretty sure the library should be able to play those videos. Okay, so we were in the sensory chapter. Anybody have any questions on sensory chapter? No questions so far? Okay, and we got as far as the ear. And we were talking about general senses and special senses. What's the big difference? Can anybody describe the big difference between a general sense and a special sense? Yeah. Yeah, I like that. General, you have receptors all over your body. Special, only in one or two locations. One or two locations. And the special senses would be olfaction, gustation, vision, hearing, and two forms of equilibrium. Kinetic equilibrium and static equilibrium. And we're going to go over that today because it's a part of the ear. So when we go over hearing, we'll go over the two equilibrium senses. Okay, so you guys, I know you might be talking about something pretty important and fun, but you got to go out in the hallway because I've had some complaints from students. that they can't concentrate on lecture because there's too much talking going on. So please, okay, sorry about that. Just go out in the hall and come back in. Okay, so the two senses of equilibrium and hearing are in the ear. And so let's start looking at the ear, ears and hearing. I think we looked at this last time, and that is the compartments of the ear. Ear can be broken down into three main regions, exterior, middle, and inner ear. And we said that this external ear right here just helps focus sound waves into the inner ear via the middle ear. All right, so here is the external acoustic meatus, and the auricle is part of the external ear. And then that sound energy can't get into the middle ear because it's blocked by a membrane. And you all should know the name of that membrane. What's the name of that membrane right there? Tympanic membrane, right? Here's the tympanic membrane. And it's going to vibrate back and forth, just like the head of a drum when you hit a drum head. It's going to bounce back and forth. Okay, I still hear a lot of grumbling. You guys should probably just really go outside, okay? So people can hear, even though I'm using amplification, in case your tympanic membrane isn't vibrating enough, it still is a little confusing to people, okay, if they hear many conversations at one time. All right, so that sound energy, which is a variation of pressure above and below atmospheric pressure, will vibrate the tympanic membrane, and connected to the tympanic membrane are auditory ossicles, and one in particular, which I see right here, which is the malleus, or no, sorry, incus. Here's the incus that starts to vibrate, then that's going to vibrate the malleus, and then that's going to vibrate the stapes back and forth. All right, so this is the inner ear, or I'm sorry, this is the middle ear. And it's in just some air, it's not in fluid, so these bones vibrate very nicely. And if the pressure inside the middle ear increases, it's going to push the tympanic membrane all the way into the external acoustic meatus, and then it won't vibrate if there's high pressure in the middle ear. And if the tympanic membrane can't vibrate, can you hear anything? You can't hear anything, right? And if the pressure inside the middle ear is so low that the tympanic membrane gets pushed all the way into the middle ear over here, it can't vibrate. And can you hear anything? Again, that tympanic membrane has to vibrate in order for you to hear something. So this, the air pressure in the external acoustic meatus, which is atmospheric pressure, should be the same as the middle ear. That should be atmospheric pressure as well, so that the tympanic membrane sits right in the middle and can vibrate back and forth. So how do we equalize pressure in the middle ear so that it's the same as the pressure in the outer ear? Anybody ever have to do that? Yes, everybody has had to do that. Okay, sometimes you hold your nose and do a Valsalva maneuver, which means you compress your chest and abdominal compartment and increase the pressure in the back of your mouth. Well, what do we call the back of your mouth in anatomy? What do we call that? It's your throat commonly, but in anatomy, what part of your body is that? What part is your throat? That is your pharynx. That's right. When you have a sore throat, you have a pharyngitis, right? Because that's your throat, back of your mouth, back of your nasal cavity, behind the larynx. And so there is a tube right here that's connected to your pharynx, and it's called the pharyngotympanic tube. And this makes sure that the pressure in this middle ear right here is the same as the external ear so that this tympanic membrane can vibrate back and forth. Now, when you have a cold or an inflammation, then this tympanic tube gets blocked, air can't get up into this middle part of the ear, and sometimes you can't hear quite as well when you have a cold. All right, and especially if you have an infection of the middle ear, then these gets filled with fluid and maybe pus, for instance, and so these auditory ossicles can't vibrate back and forth, and again, you lose some partial sense of hearing, and maybe it might be almost complete depending on how impacted this area is. Anybody know what that's called when you get an infection of the middle ear? Otitis. Yeah, that's what we call otitis media. Remember, otic stands for anything to do with the ear. So sometimes a physician looks in your ear with a little device. It's a scope. What kind of scope is used to look inside somebody's ear? That's called an otoscope, right? So otic refers to the ear. Much different than an instrument a physician would use to look inside your eye, to look at the retina. That's not an otoscope. What is that thing called? Looks similar. That is called an ophthalmoscope. Ophthalmoscope, all right? So remember, oto means ear. We haven't talked about the eye yet. All right, so notice that the tympanic membrane has a big surface area compared to the membrane that's covering the vestibule. So here now is the inner ear. There's a membrane that's connected up to the base of the stapes. So when the stapes vibrates back and forth, then that membrane vibrates back and forth. And can you tell me, what's the shape of the base of the stapes right here? Does it look like a square? Does it look like a triangle? Does it look like a perfect circle? No. So far, I'm really off base. You got to tell me. What does it look like? It looks like an oval. Yeah, I like that. It looks like an oval. And the name of that membrane underneath the stapes, hence, is called the oval window. So that's how sound energy enters the inner ear through the oval window. All right. So why is this apparatus here? Why is the oval window so small and the tympanic membrane relatively large? And why do we have all these bones in the middle ear? And that's because sound does not enter an aqueous environment. It does not go into water very easily. If I'm giving lecture and we're at a swimming pool and you're really tired of my lecture, what can you do if you don't want to listen to me anymore? You just put your head underwater, and even though I keep lecturing, even though I'm amplifying my voice, that sound won't go underwater to where your ears are. So there has to be a special apparatus that can take sound energy that's in the air and put it in this underwater environment inside the inner ear. And that's what this thing does. You could sort of think of this as amplification, right? Because here is a big membrane, here is a small membrane. It's almost like amplifying the sound so that it gets into the inner ear. Okay, so then, once we're in the inner ear, so now you also know the name of that pharyngotympanic tube and the function of it. What's another name for pharyngotympanic tube? I know you all like pharyngotympanic tube because it reminds you of what the job of it is. But what's another name? Auditory tube, we see that here. And it even has another name, right? So even in anatomy, things can have a lot of different names. You all have a lot of different names. It's also called Eustachian tube. Yeah, Eustachian tube, pharyngotympanic tube, auditory tube, making sure that pressure is equalized on either side of the tympanic membrane. And even if you take an airplane ride and the pressure decreases as you go up in altitude, you need to equalize that pressure. And if for some reason you can't, then that tympanic membrane is going to get pushed way out over here, and it's going to be painful when that happens. And so what kind of people commonly have otitis media, infection of the middle ear? Yeah, children, right? Especially babies. And when they're on an airplane, sometimes they really misbehave when you're taking off or landing. And one of the reasons is because their ears hurt terribly bad when they have otitis media, right? So be nice to them. Don't tell them to shut up, and certainly don't smack them, right? Because they're in a lot of pain. And you would be too if you can't clear your ears. All right, so now we have that sound energy in this part of the inner ear. The inner ear has three pieces to it. It has the cochlea, which looks like a snail, the vestibule, which is the entrance to the inner ear, and these semicircular canals. And these are all related to the three different senses that we have on the inner ear. Cochlea is for hearing. The vestibule has organs for linear acceleration or static equilibrium in the vestibule. And in the semicircular canals, we have kinetic equilibrium or angular acceleration. One way to think about angular acceleration is spinning, because fluid can actually flow in a circular pattern through these semicircular canals, right? So that circular pattern, one way to think of that is a spinning motion. All right, so I guess make sure you know everything on this slide. Like, for instance, what's the nerve? And it's a cranial nerve. I'll give you a hint. It's a cranial nerve that takes all of this information to the brain. I can see it here. Okay, the cochlear nerve comes from the cochlea. The vestibular nerve comes from the vestibular apparatus. They join together to form commonly what we used to call the auditory nerve years ago, years and years and years ago. But is it just carrying hearing information? No, it's carrying equilibrium information. So we simplified the name of this nerve. Now we call it the vestibulocochlear nerve, right? Vestibulocochlear. And I think it's what? Number 8 of the cranial nerves. All right. So that's good for this figure. All right. So here we have external ear. Here we have middle ear. Here is the inner ear. Guess what? I need to go back because we're going to talk about equilibrium senses first. All right. So here is that bony labyrinth inside the inner ear. Right, and I see the cochlea once again, so we really zoomed into this region on that figure that we were looking at. Here is the vestibule, here are the semicircular canals once again. And inside the vestibule and semicircular canals, there are certain kinds of apparatus, certain sense organs that can sense acceleration. And these things actually have little crystals associated with them that we call otoliths. Otoliths are tiny crystals that we find in the utricle and saccule that we see right here. These are the two sense organs for linear acceleration or static equilibrium. And at the base of the semicircular canals, you can see a little bulge here, a little bulge here, and a little bulge here. There's a special organ there that can sense angular acceleration. They don't have otoliths, but they have a gelatinous mass associated with them. So we need to talk about how these things actually operate when we apply different kinds of forces to them. Okay, so the utricle and saccule, sometimes we call these maculae, they're in the vestibule, and the organ for angular acceleration in the ampule are what we call the crista ampullaris. So there's a crista ampullaris in each of these different ampullae. Inside that bony labyrinth, there is a membranous labyrinth, okay, that contains endolymph. All these different chambers are filled with fluid, right, and that's why we need that middle ear to amplify sound before it gets into the inner ear. So you got the bony labyrinth, right, the cochlea, the vestibule, semicircular canals, and then here is the membranous labyrinth on the inside. Now, where do we have all of these structures? Where do we have the bony labyrinth and the membranous labyrinth inside? All right, so these are hard calcified structures, but where are they located? What bone of the head are they in? Are they a facial bone or a cranial bone, or what can you tell me about that? Or are they not in a bone? Yeah, they're in the bone, and they're in the temporal bone, right? Just sort of in that petrous region of the temporal bone. So you got bones within bones, and then you don't forget about those auditory ossicles on the outside in the middle ear. Okay. So linear acceleration from the utricle and saccule, angular acceleration from the semicircular canals, and you could say actually the three crista ampullaris in this location here. All right. The linear acceleration, you can tell horizontal acceleration and vertical acceleration. So you have two. You have utricle and saccule. And for spinning, you have three. Why do you have three accelerometers for angular acceleration or spinning? Because what are the ways that you can spin? One way to think of this is how many planes could you use to image your body? There's this one, which is? What is this one right here? Can you see me? I can see you, so you can see me. This is sagittal, and this is, come on you guys, you've got to help me out here. What's this? Coronal, and what's this one? Transverse, right? So there are three planes that define our spatial environment, and so there are three semicircular canals so that we can tell if we're spinning in either one of those different planes. And if it is an oblique plane, then there's going to be partial information from two of these planes added together so that you can tell if you're spinning at an angle from either of these standard planes. Okay, so how does this work? In the vestibular apparatus, which is the vestibule and the semicircular canals, have special things that we call hair cells. So here is just the top of a hair cell, and it has some projections sticking off of them These are a little bit bigger than microvilli, but they're not really flagella because they don't move around. So these can move when force is applied to them, but they don't move on their own, not like cilia and flagella. Right, so there's microtubules inside of these. So there are a bunch of stereocilia, and these all are connected to one really large kinocilium. Right, and so when these hair cells move, right, then the stereocilia move back and forth, and they're going to pull or push on the kinocilium. And when that happens, okay, if the kinocilium that I see right here is moved away from the stereocilia, then that causes depolarization of this cell, which means that there has to be what? Like sodium channels that open up. That's usually how we think of depolarization. And that's going to increase the number of action potentials. So that's how we stimulate this hair cell, by pushing up against that kinocilium. And I see so many action potentials down here in this very bottom row, the third row, that it just kind of just looks like a big solid line, right? So that is stimulating. We have a lot of action potentials for a certain period of time. Right? But if these hair cells, or if the stereocilia are bent the other way, if they pull on the kinocilium, that inhibits the cell, so that closes sodium channels or maybe opens potassium channels, which inhibits the cell. And look at the production of action potentials. It is what? Way less. And so then that information goes to the brain so that you can appreciate those different senses of acceleration because of these hair cells and these special adaptations on the top of these hair cells. So both for kinetic equilibrium and static equilibrium have this kind of cell. So why do we have these different senses? Even though it's the same type of receptor cell. All right, well, let's look at the utricle and saccule first. So we're looking inside the vestibule, and I can see some hair cells. Can you see a hair cell here and here and here? And you can see the stereocilia poking up from the epithelium, and they poke into this mass, which is like gelatin, and embedded in the gelatin and on top of the gelatin are those crystals, calcium carbonate crystals. And they're pretty small. You probably can't really see them with your naked eye, but if you had a microscope, they'd look real pretty, like a little rock garden growing right here. And these act as weights, and gravity pulls on these otoliths. When your head is upright and stationary, they push straight down on the stereocilia, and they don't bend to the right or to the left. They're strong enough to hold up those otoliths. Right? But as soon as you start to accelerate, or if you bend your head forward, then these otoliths pull on that gelatinous mass and it deforms the stereocilia. And what does that do? We saw that on the previous slide. It changes the rate of action potentials going to the brain. So your brain knows that there has been a change in acceleration, and it can tell exactly which way that goes. So your mind can tell what the orientation of your head is based on the bending of these stereocilia in the maculae, which is the saccule and utricle inside the vestibule, because these otoliths deform these stereocilia, which pull or push on that kinocilium. All right, so that's the sense of linear acceleration due to the utricle and saccule. Okay, one is for horizontal and one is for vertical acceleration that I see here and here. Those are the organs, utricle and saccule organs for linear acceleration. Now, as far as angular acceleration goes, then we need the semicircular canals. And inside the ampule, we have a crista ampullaris. And the crista ampullaris is going to be similar, okay, to the otolith organs. And here is an example. So here's an ampule. We're just seeing a little tiny part of it, but you can kind of appreciate a little bulge. Here is some epithelium with hair cells embedded in it, and I can see stereocilia, and I can see one big kinocilium, and they poke up into this mass. And again, it's like a gelatinous mass that we call the cupula, and it goes pretty much all the way across from one side of an ampule to the other. And embedded in this area is fluid. Remember, we call that endolymph. And so there's a big semicircular canal. And these The stereocilia are going to bend one way or the other depending on our spinning motion. All right, so we said that this can sense angular acceleration. And I talked about linear acceleration, but I didn't say what acceleration is. What does acceleration mean? I think you have a much better idea if you know what acceleration means. What do you have in your car when you're driving down the freeway? What do you have? What do you call that you look at? Make sure you don't get a speeding ticket. You have a speedometer. Yeah, speedometer measures velocity, right? So if you're going 60 miles an hour down the freeway, chances are you won't get a ticket. And if you stay at that constant velocity, you are not accelerating, because acceleration is a change in velocity. For instance, when you're at a stoplight and you're at zero velocity and then go across the intersection starting to speed up, your speed changes, your velocity changes. The only way you can go from zero to 60 miles an hour is when you accelerate. That we call that acceleration. Acceleration is a change in velocity. Okay. All right, so when you're standing still for a long period of time, that fluid inside the ear isn't moving either. And I guess I have an example right here that I want to show you. So here I have a nice cup with some fluid in there. The fluid inside this cup represents endolymph, the fluid that's inside the semicircular canals. And this piece of paper right here represents the crista ampullaris, which is connected to your head. So as soon as you move your head, the crista ampullaris is just going to move with it because they're all anchored together. All right, now what about endolymph when you start to move your head, especially when you start to spin, because we're talking about angular acceleration. All right, what happens to that fluid? You're familiar because you've probably heard this commercial, if you have time to watch TV this semester, probably not very much. But you've probably heard a commercial that says, a body in motion does what? Stays in motion. A body at rest stays at rest. Okay, extra credit back there. Yeah, so that's that commercial, right? Body in motion stays in motion. Body at rest stays at rest. So here we have a body at rest. And if I try to move it, like if I try to move it with this piece of paper, what is it going to have a tendency to do? Body at rest stays at rest, right? So this is the endolymph inside the semicircular canals. We're going to move the crista ampullaris very quickly. And let's see what happens to this fluid. All right, can we do that? Is there a holiday coming up? Ah, spring break. Okay, so you're going to be someplace on a picnic bench with a bunch of food on the bench, or maybe just beer bottles, I'm not sure. Okay, and you're going to show off and say, hey, I can take that tablecloth out from underneath all of that stuff without spilling anything. And is anybody going to take your bet? They're going to say no, because of course you can do that. You can do what? Just like that. Because a body at rest stays at rest, right? All right, so what did we do? We moved somebody's head really fast, but what about the endolymph? It stayed stationary, so that endolymph is pushing on those stereocilia, because the stereocilia is moving with your head, but that fluid is staying stationary, so the stereocilia start to move in one direction. All right, so now just say you're spinning for a long period of time. You're spinning and spinning. That endolymph, even though it didn't want to start, starts spinning along with you, right? And it catches up to your spinning speed, right? And then all of a sudden you stop all of a sudden. So now you're not spinning. What about that endolymph? Our body in motion likes to stay in motion. Okay, let's see if I can demonstrate that. And when the endolymph stays in motion, then it pushes the stereocilia the other way, changing the rate of action potentials to the brain for spinning operation, for spinning sensation. All right, so I got to start off slow, right? Because otherwise I'll leave this thing behind. So I'll start off slow, and then I'll stop the crista ampullaris, which is the paper. What's going to happen to the endolymph? It's going to keep moving, right? So I'm going to go like this and stop. Did you see it move? Okay, so a body in motion stays in motion. As that endolymph was starting to slow down, that pushes the crista ampullaris the other way. And so that's what we see on this slide right here. But if you're spinning at a constant speed, it doesn't sense anything. You have to be either starting to spin or stopping to spin to be acceleration. Because as we saw over here, what happens if we're at a constant speed? Nothing, right? It's only when we stop suddenly or start that the crista ampullaris gets information. Okay, so those are the two senses from the middle ear, two of the three. So we got one more sense left to talk about, and that is hearing. And I gave you a little bit of an introduction to hearing already. All right, the outer, middle, and inner ears, those auditory ossicles. All right, well, something about that pressure wave you should know. Okay, a wave has some attributes associated with it, and that is the intensity. Intensity is the amplitude or the peak of a wave. So think of a wave maybe on the ocean that we all have seen. Right, the bigger the wave, how does the intensity go as the wave gets bigger? The intensity increases, right? Directly related. Right, the frequency of waves is how fast they come ashore. Some waves are really long, and it takes a long time for a wave to come through. The way that we measure frequency is in hertz, right? And that is just waves per second. Waves per second, but sometimes we just call it cycles per second. Okay, I felt a wave on Friday go through my house. Right, it was an earthquake at 9 o'clock. I felt a big one. Okay, I don't know if you felt the wave go through your house. Fortunately, it was not very large in what? Intensity, right, for me. But it was pretty intense for some people, depending on where you live. Okay, and I don't know what the hertz was, but it was pretty slow. It was maybe one cycle per second, maybe two. All right, so what can we hear? We can hear up to maybe 20,000 cycles per second. Okay, and we can start hearing, maybe about 80 cycles per second, somewhere in that range. All right, so it's just a variation above and below atmospheric pressure. So we can talk about the frequency, which is hertz, and intensity, which is the loudness. All right, but you're familiar with frequency because you can hear different sounds when the frequency changes. How does the sound change when the frequency changes of a sound? It is by... Yeah, I like that, a deeper, lower note, right? The tone of that sound changes, right? Or the note, the tone. So a high frequency, we call that a high note. It's a high pitch. Who can give a high pitch? I can't give a high pitch. Right? I can only give you low pitches because my voice is low. Right? So as that frequency increases, then it sounds higher and higher in frequency. All right, so we know a lot about this slide. So here we have some, what do we have right here? What is this thing going up and going down? What is this going up and down? This is a, right here, what do I have? That's a wave. Yeah, that's a wave. Okay, so here's a wave. And the top of that wave, right down to right at this middle point, that's what we call the intensity. Right, and I see another wave over here. I wish I could tell you what colors these are. Now, is the wave that I have the cursor on, and maybe it's green, maybe I heard green, is the green wave higher in frequency or lower in frequency? It's lower because the wavelength is longer. It takes much more time to complete one cycle. All right, so here is a wave that's high in frequency. And then lastly, we have, a light blue one here? The light blue, is this the highest frequency or the lowest frequency? Lowest frequency, this is right. So, what we've done right here is that we've taken that cochlea that looks like a snail and unrolled it. Right? So you can really just unroll that cochlea. So the bony labyrinth is out on the outside, the membranous labyrinth is on the inside, and then we even have some tissue and different kinds of fluid inside that membranous labyrinth. Right? And so here is the oval window, which introduces those sound waves into the ear, and they penetrate the cochlea differently. All right, the high frequency, the high pitched sounds, right, only travel a very short distance into the cochlea. The very low notes travel all the way deep into the cochlea. Right, so the end of the cochlea over here, which is what we call the helicotrema, is responsible for low frequencies. The area that's close to the oval window is responsible for high frequencies, and these cells in this area here are responsible for mid-range frequencies. Right, and so as we move across this right here is what we call, there's a tectorial membrane, with the Organ of Cordy in this region right here. Right, so when you look and see what areas of that Organ of Cordy get stimulated, I think of a musical instrument. And actually, even the way it's drawn kind of reminds me of that instrument. What kind of instrument, if you push it on one end, makes a high frequency, and if you push it all the way on the other end, it makes a low frequency? Yeah, a piano. So actually, you could think of a cochlea as being a piano. Of course, you got one on one side, one on the other side. And how would you look with those two pianos in your ears, sticking out, if it was straight like this? Well, it would look kind of silly, plus you could break them off. So what has evolution figured out how to do? Take that piano, roll it up so that it fits inside your inner ear very, very nicely. Okay, so high frequencies stimulate over here, low frequencies more toward the helicotrema. Now, in a piano, why is that? Why is it that one end plays low notes? There's something different about that piano on one side compared to the other. Okay, yeah, the frequency is different. Why is the frequency different? The length of the strings, right, or cables or whatever. The length of the strings for the low notes are very long, right, and they're very thick, so they vibrate at a low frequency. What about the high frequency way over here? What can you tell me about the strings? They're very short and they're thin, so they vibrate at a fast frequency, high frequency. So the shape of structures determines what kind of frequency they vibrate at. The bigger they are, the lower the frequency. The smaller they are, the higher frequency. And as a matter of fact, the helicotrema over here is the widest part of the cochlea, and the thinnest part is this part over here by the oval window. So just based on the size and shape of the cochlea, these different parts of the Organ of Cordy get stimulated. All right, so sound enters oval window, right, through the scale of vestibuli, and depending on the shape of this inner compartment right here, right, that we call the cochlear duct, high frequency is going to move across it and vibrate these cells, while not vibrating these down over here, into the scala tympani, and then out this area right here, because that sound energy, if it's trapped inside the cochlea, could damage all of these cells. Right, so here is another membrane that vibrates back and forth, and that releases that sound pressure energy, right, and that protects the cochlear duct right here. And what's the shape of this one? Nice and round. This is how sound energy is released from the cochlea. All right, so sound energy takes a transit, moves across the cochlear duct from the scala vestibuli into the scala tympani. Right, and what it does, it vibrates this middle compartment right here. So what do you have that can measure that vibration? Maybe you're familiar with like Hessian corpuscles and things like that, but there's something that works a little bit better in the ear. Oh, here's some frequency information. 500 hertz is what compared to 2,000 is like 1/4 of the frequency, right? Here's 20,000 over here. What's that? 10 times the frequency compared to 2,000 hertz. Voices are usually around 1,000 or 2,000 hertz, somewhere in that region. Okay, so let's zoom in just to one region right here. And so I see the scala vestibuli on the top, tympani on the bottom, just like we saw over here, right? So here's vestibuli, here's tympani, cochlear duct right smack in the middle. So here's the cochlear duct. But we see that the scala tympani doesn't have any structure in it. Neither does the vestibuli. But now what about the cochlear duct? Do you see any structure in the cochlear duct? Yes, we do. I see this right here. Okay, so I see something that almost looks like a gelatinous mass, but it's a little bit sturdier than what we have seen before. We call this the tectorial membrane. But it is soft enough so that when sound moves across the cochlear duct into the scala tympani, it can vibrate up and down. Okay, so let's look at this area because I want to actually point out some more details. This area right here has some receptor cells, very similar to what we found in the maculae and the crista ampullaris. What was the receptor cell that started electrical information going to the brain? What kind of cell was that? What kind of cell was that? Very strange. It had these stereocilia on top of them. what do we call that cell? A hair cell. Yeah, even though it doesn't really look like hair, but with a microscope, I see some hair cells up over here. So it's the same kind of cell, but totally different kind of sensation. All right, so let's zoom into that area. All right, so there's a basilar membrane. Here's a tectorial membrane. And the stereocilia from these hair cells poke up into this tectorial membrane. So when the tectorial membrane vibrates, what happens to the stereocilia? They bend as well, right? And then that changes the frequency of action potentials that are produced by these cells, and the frequency of action potentials going through what the cochlear nerve, it's going to join the vestibular nerve, right? So it's going to change the rate of action potentials in that vestibulocochlear nerve, and it's going to take it to the brain. Okay, and so remember, this is just one region. So if we're looking at these cells right here, and here's another inner hair cell, this tectorial membrane is going to vibrate how? How is this thing going to vibrate? How about if this right here, right, is in this part of the cochlear duct? What's going to stimulate that tectorial membrane? How's it going to vibrate if it's over here? Will it vibrate very rapidly? No, only for very slow undulations. And over here, that tectorial membrane is smaller, so it's going to vibrate more rapidly as a result. All right, so don't forget, as the distance from the oval window changes, so does the frequency, kind of just like a piano. All right, and all these nerves then go to your primary auditory cortex, which is in the temporal lobe, and the temporal lobe sensation is arranged just like a piano as well. So if you stimulate one region of the temporal lobe, you're going to hear low frequencies, right, and then stimulate areas next to it, mid-range frequencies, and then areas farther away, then you're going to hear high frequencies. Right? And so these nerves just go to different parts of that temporal lobe, the auditory cortex. And you have the perception of sound. Now, what's the language that this vestibular cochlear nerve is sending to your brain? What does it sound like if we were to actually be able to hear it? What does an action potential sound like? It's just a blip. That's right. It's just a blip. And by the frequency of those blips going to the auditory cortex, then you appreciate sound. You can appreciate notes. You can appreciate music based on what? Just the frequency of those blips and where those blips go, what part of the cerebral cortex they go to, whether it's a high note or low note. Okay. So here's the pathway. From the organ of Corti, right, in the cochlear duct, right, the vestibular cochlear nerve brings it into the medulla oblongata, and then there's a synapse there, some signal processing, and then it goes into the midbrain. And do you remember the inferior colliculus from anatomy? It's part of the corpora quadrigemina, and we said that in anatomy that's responsible for auditory reflexes. Right, so the right and left colliculi share information, and so the colliculus can tell you what direction sound is coming from, because sound arrives at one ear before the other. If sound is coming from my right side, then right, the right side of my right ear picks it up before the left, and the colliculus right here, the inferior colliculi, can determine what that difference in time is, and then you get an idea of where the sound is coming from. Okay, and then the thalamus. Then we got neurons going to the thalamus. What's the job of the thalamus once again? From anatomy, it's a relay station, right? Almost all sensory information has to go to the thalamus, and then the thalamus locates it, okay, and directs it to the proper cerebral cortex, the proper part of the cerebral cortex. So if this is auditory information, it's going to direct that information, which is what? Just action potentials, to the temporal lobe that we see right here. If it's sensation on the surface of your body, where is the thalamus going to send those action potentials? We haven't really talked about this. Oh, maybe we did. It's going to go to the post-central gyrus, right? And if it is visual information, where is the thalamus going to send information? To the occipital lobe. So depending on what part of the cerebral cortex gets stimulated, then you have a different sensation, even though only action potentials go there. All right, so it's amazing our brain can make that transformation. All right, so that is hearing. Now, in Blackboard, you have something that looks like this. I didn't stop the slideshow. I'm great. Structures and functions of the special senses of the labyrinth. Right? So, what is a labyrinth? Organ cordae, vestibule, semicircular canals. Right? And those are what? In the petrous region of the temporal bone. What kind? How many senses do you have in there? How many special senses? Okay. Look at that first column. How many numbers do I have there? 1, 2, 3. That's right. So the first one was the last one we talked about, but is hearing. And then the second one is static equilibrium. But what does static equilibrium measure? Acceleration, but only in a linear direction, right? Forwards and backwards, or up and down, but not spinning. And then the third one is kinetic equilibrium, which is angular acceleration, which is spinning. Right, but not at a constant velocity. You have to change your velocity, like start or stop, in order for these things. All right, and here are the different parts of the ear, external, middle, and inner part. For kinetic equilibrium, do we need an external ear? We do not, right? If we completely lose the external ear, we don't lose any appreciation for angular acceleration. What about static equilibrium? Do we need outer ear? No. What about for hearing? Yeah, we do. We need that external acoustic meatus, right, and the auricle to help funnel sound energy, right? And what's that thing that separates the middle ear from the outer ear? It's a membrane. Yeah, nice tympanic membrane. When sound pressure hits that membrane, it vibrates back and forth. So, do you need a middle ear for hearing? Absolutely. You need the tympanic membrane, auditory ossicles. And what about for static equilibrium and kinetic equilibrium? Absolutely not, right? So, what about the inner ear? What's necessary? What senses are necessary or have to have a functioning inner ear? All three, right? Hearing in the cochlea, static equilibrium in the vestibule, kinetic equilibrium in the semicircular canals. All right, so I just listed for you the bony labyrinth for these special senses, so make sure you know which one pairs up with each one. And what's inside the cochlea that allows you to, what is the cochlea responsible for? Hearing. What allows you to hear? What's the membranous labyrinth? We call that the cochlear duct. And what's the organ in the cochlear duct that allows you to hear? It is the organ of Corti. And the organ of Corti is made up of cells. And what's the receptor cell? A hair cell, right? When those hairs are bent, stereocilia are bent, that changes action potentials going to the brain. All right, static equilibrium. Bony labyrinth, we said, was the vestibule. The organs are the utricle and saccule. The receptor organ is what we call a maculae. And the maculae have what kind of cell that allows you to appreciate linear acceleration? Hair cells, once again, right? And the same thing for kinetic equilibrium. Semicircular canals, the bony labyrinth, membranous labyrinth, those semicircular ducts. The organ is the crista ampullaris, and the crista ampullaris is made up of hair cells. So in each case, hair cells are used to change the rate of action potentials going to your brain, and you have three completely different kinds of sensations, right? And those different sensations are a result of where those action potentials end up, right? And the frequency represents the intensity. But the exact modality of that sense is determined by the exact location on the cerebral cortex that receives those depolarizations or blips. Okay, so this is a good thing that you should make sure that you can draw out. Okay. So here is a good exam table. You can answer a lot of questions with that one. All right, so we talked about smell, we talked about olfaction, hearing, static, and kinetic equilibrium. That's five special senses. And how many does that leave us? Just one, okay, which is vision. And so you need receptors. What kind of receptors do you need for vision? You need little vibration receptors, like hair cells? No, you need photoreceptors, right? Photoreceptors. And photoreceptors can transduce light energy into electrical energy inside neurons, right? So like the organ of Corti can transduce pressure energy into electrical energy, right? But the eyes transduce light energy into action potentials or electrochemical energy. And light is a wave, sort of like sound. Sound is a wave, light is a wave, but sound is a mechanical wave, light is an electromagnetic wave. So it's not a physical wave. It has electrical and magnetic properties, and depending on the frequency, okay, those waves have different energy associated with them, and the way that our brain interprets those different energies is by, what do we have right here? Is by color, right? So different energies have different colors. We appreciate that with different colors. So what I see right here is a rainbow. So this one, I hope, has all the colors of the rainbow in it, because sunlight coming from the sun is what we call white light. It has a combination of all colors. Every single color is in sunlight. And if we break white light down with a prism or maybe a raindrop, what do we get? We get a rainbow that we see up over here. And there's a little saying that you can use to label what these colors are. Like, I could probably tell you what these colors are because I know this little saying. Okay, so here is red. Here is orange. Here's yellow. Here's green, blue, indigo, and violet. Nice. But that's because I don't see these colors. I just know what the name that we use. Roy G. Biv is the name of somebody that we can use to know all these different colors. All right, and so you can see that the frequency changes, right, when the color of that light changes. All right, so here is, let's talk about the structure of an eye just a little bit. In anatomy, you're sort of familiar with these things. All right, so what adjusts the amount of light entering your eyes? What changes the pupil diameter is another way of saying that. A microscope has one of these things too. It is the iris, yeah. So if you constrict the iris, the pupil gets small, it lets less light in. If you dilate the iris, the pupil gets bigger, it lets more light in. Like right now, all of your pupils, I'm sure, are dilated because it's kind of dark in here. How does that happen? Two sets of muscles. There are circular muscles that I see here and radial muscles as well. And so there's always a balance between these two muscles. They work antagonistically to each other. Right, so one causes pupil constriction, the other pupil dilation. And from one of those previous chapters, you probably know which one is which. Which one causes dilation of the autonomic nervous system? Well, how many divisions does the autonomic nervous system have? Yeah, two. So fortunately, we just have two different kinds of muscles right here. Which one causes dilation of those two nervous systems? Yeah, sympathetic, right? When you need to bring in a lot of information, your pupil dilates. Okay, and that's because these radial fibers right here contract. The radial fibers contract, pull on the circular layer, and then the pupil gets bigger as these radial fibers contract. And that's under sympathetic stimulation, causes pupil dilation. Under normal circumstances, parasympathetic and sympathetic kind of balance out. You have more or less a normal pupil diameter. And that's because the radial fibers and the circular fibers are contracting mostly to the same degree. Right? But when you're in a rested state, very relaxed state, then the parasympathetic nervous system takes over, and the radial fibers that I see right here relax, the circular fibers contract, and when they contract, then the circle gets smaller. Right, so the circle gets smaller when the circular muscle fibers contract, and you can see that the pupils actually get smaller when that happens, and that's due to parasympathetic stimulation that happens in bright light. All right, so now how did we characterize the parasympathetic nervous system? I just thought of a nice little test. I don't think it's going to work. Maybe it will work. You should do this experiment. How do we characterize the sympathetic nervous system? It's what kind of nervous system? The fight or flight, yep. And what about the parasympathetic? Rest and digest, okay. So I'm thinking about this digestion. What happens to your pupil diameter when you eat something, when you're digesting? I never thought of this before, but if you can rely on that rest and digest nervous system, what would you expect? Constriction, Okay? I don't think that really happens. Probably because you're really excited when you see a pizza or margarita, right? So that balances out. But check that. Check somebody's pupil sometime. Okay? While you're, or maybe right after a meal. I don't think that happens, but I wouldn't be surprised if it does. Okay? So parasympathetic, pupil constriction, sympathetic, pupil dilation, because there are two different kinds of muscle fibers. Smooth muscle fibers oriented in different directions. Okay, so that's how our eye adjusts for light. There is another process that your eye has to go through, and it's called accommodation. So you've got to be definitely aware of what accommodation means. And it has to do with focusing on an object depending on how what the proximity is to you, whether it's close to you or far away. Something has to change. So can you focus on something that's close to you and something that's far away from you at the same time? No. It's got to be one or the other. Right? And your eye has to change, that process of changing from focusing on something that's close to you as opposed to far away, we call that accommodation. And again, it's going to utilize a certain kind of muscle, and that muscle is what we call the ciliary body or ciliary muscle. Right? And what's the shape of this ciliary muscle? It's a smooth muscle, so I wouldn't want to call this an orbicularis because that's skeletal. But nonetheless, what kind of shape is this ciliary muscle? It's circular, right? Just like what we saw in the eye. And when the circular muscle contracts, what happens to the diameter of this circle when it contracts? When it contracts, the diameter gets smaller, right? When that muscle relaxes, the elastic properties then makes the circle get bigger as a result. All right, so I want you to just kind of remember that. Okay, that's going to change the property of the lens. So the lens has curvature to it, and that will bend light so that things will end up very nice and focused on your retina. If they don't focus on the retina, then the image is going to be blurred. So the ciliary muscle contracts and relaxes, and it can change the tension on these suspensory ligaments that are attached to the lens. Now this is kind of strange, because when you think when a muscle contracts, what happens to tension in a tendon that's connected to that muscle when the muscle contracts? The tension increases, right, and it moves your skeleton around. It's a little bit different for this circular muscle, because when the circular muscle relaxes, when the circle gets bigger, that's when tension is applied to these suspensory ligaments, right? When the circle gets bigger, it pulls more on the lens. When the ciliary muscle contracts, the circle gets smaller, and that releases tension on the lens, right? And that's going to change the shape of the lens. So here I can see the lens relatively flat on this top circumstance. The second row down over here, I can see that the lens has more curvature to it. Okay? And that's because in this first row, it's flat because the suspensory muscle or the ciliary body has relaxed. The diameter is bigger. That puts more tension on the suspensory ligaments, and that puts tension on the lens to help flatten it out. And they can't curve light quite as much. When these muscles relax, right, then the diameter decreases. It releases some tension on the suspensory ligaments, and then it just allows the elastic properties of the lens to make it thick once again. So it's changing shape all the time, depending on where you are looking. All right, and that distance is about 20 feet. So we can see things with our near vision up to 20 feet. After that, we need to use our far vision, and the lens has to become much more curved when that happens. All right, so who doesn't believe me that you can't see up close and far away at the same time? It's used in cinema photography all the time. They focus on one person and then the other, and then you kind of follow who's talking. So who's ever talking usually is in focus, right? So how could you prove that to yourself right now? Well, you could take an object like your fingernail, right? Put it in front of you. Just hold it right in front of you, arm's length, and focus on the fingernail, and your fingernail is going to be nice and focused. Now what about everything behind it? It's going to be blurry. Now focus on everything behind it, and now look at your fingernail. Do you see your fingernail? Well, I see one, but I see two, and they're really blurry. I don't know how many you see, for sure, right? So it's either close up or far away, but not both at the same time. And what is that process that allows you to change your distance of focus from your eye, that is accommodation, right? But in order for your eyes to accommodate, this lens has to be nice and elastic. It has to be able to change shape. And as you get older, the lens has more and more trouble, right? It just gets stiffer and stiffer and stiffer. And then you need different kinds of glasses, right? Like maybe reading glasses to look at things up close because the lens can't change shape enough so that you can just focus normally with that. And it also takes longer for the lens to change shape as well. Okay, so that's accommodation. Here is, this is an exam figure right here. Okay, and this, these different graphs right here show us, all right, the shape of an eyeball. All right, and I see one eyeball here that looks pretty spherical or circular in one dimension. All right, I see another eyeball down over here. And what can you tell me about this eyeball? Way too long, right? And what about this eyeball here? It's short. All right, and our eyeballs change shape all the time, and when they change shape, especially the distance from the lens to where the retina is located, here's where the retina is located, when this distance changes, then our vision is going to change as well. And that happens pretty much through our whole lifetime. Some people's vision gets better, okay, as they get older. Most of us, it kind of gets worse, but sometimes it gets better, but it certainly does change depending on how your head changes shape as we get older. Of course, our bones are remodeling themselves all the time, and certain parts of our body grow all the time. Like, what part of your body is growing all the time? Ears, nose, right? That's why your grandpa has a big nose compared to little kids. All right, so how does this affect vision? Well, there's a condition of normal vision that we call emmetropia, and the cornea is the structure here. I'm sure you're familiar with that. Light enters the cornea through the pupil, then it goes through the lens. And in this particular case, the cornea combined with the lens have just the right curvature so that when it bends light, all that light ends up at this one spot over here, and then it's going to look really nice and sharp for you. Okay, so that's going to be in focus. And if everything is nice and in focus, then you don't need any correction. You don't need any glasses when that happens. All right. Well, what happens if somebody's eyeball is too long and we don't change the shape of the cornea, shape of the lens, right? So it's still going to focus at the same location, so light comes in, but it focuses before it reaches the retina, which means that it starts to diverge once again, and so now you have a blurry image on the retina, right? If the light focuses in front of the retina, we call that nearsightedness or myopia. Right, and it just so happens that it focuses in front of the retina, but nearsightedness also means that where can you see and where can't you see? Nearsighted, you can see close up, but not far away. Right, that's usually what happens to younger people, so you just wear correction for things that are far away, but you can still see things up close. All right, so to correct this, in order to get these light rays focused over here, we need to spread these light beams out a little bit before they enter the eye, and that's what this concave lens does. It spreads the light out so that when it's bent too much, right, it still focuses on the retina over here. Hyperopia or farsightedness means that the light rays focus behind the eyeball. Eyeball is too short, and so a different kind of lens is needed instead of concave. Right, we need a convex lens that spreads. I said it wrong. Down over here, what does this concave lens do? It spreads the light rays out. Okay, so it spreads the light rays out so that they converge later on, right, at a farther distance. For hyperopia, we use the convex lens, right, and that helps focus light sooner before it enters the eye so that now it's focused on the retina, which is closer to the lens. All right, so I see two things on this eyeball that have curvature, and it bends light. So the bending of light is not demonstrated on these slides very well, but there are two things that act like a lens. What's the first thing that you see immediately that is curved that acts like a lens, that bends light? I see a lens right here, and fortunately I can see it bending light, right? But there's another thing that has curvature, and it sort of looks like maybe half a lens. Where's another thing that light goes through that has curvature to it? That cornea, look at this cornea right here. It has a lot of curvature, so it bends light as well. So the cornea acts like a lens, and as a matter of fact, that's the most important lens that we have. That does most of our focusing for us. Now, we can't change the shape of the cornea, but we would like to be able to look far away or close up. So what auxiliary structure do we have to help our vision out? We have the lens, because it can change shape. So the lens makes small corrections, all right, for our vision, but it's the cornea that makes the largest correction, the curvature of the cornea right here. Okay, and some people take advantage of that because your cornea can be surgerized to change its shape so that if you have poor vision, right, after that surgery, then light is going to focus right here on the retina the way it should to where you don't need glasses anymore. Anybody know what that procedure is called? Yeah, LASIK. Used to be really expensive. Right, so a laser is just used to burn away a couple cell layers, not on the surface of the cornea because there's an epithelium there, but the epithelial cells within the cornea changes shape. Okay, and then just in half a second, a little fraction of a second, light is going to focus on the retina, and you'll have what do we call perfect vision, 20/20, right? 20/20 vision immediately after that surgery. All right, but what's the downside to that? Okay, well, the upside is that surgery requires just some manipulation right on the surface of the eye. You don't have to go digging around inside somebody's eye. Right, we don't have to pull this lens out, stick another one in, right? We just surgerize the cornea. So that seems really nice and simple, and indeed that is pretty simple. Okay, if the computer makes the measurement properly, and if the computer controls the laser properly, right? What happens if there is a problem in making that measurement, or the laser didn't do its job properly? Then, right, you don't have perfect vision. And it's very hard to correct. It's very hard to reverse that particular procedure, right? So if there are any mistakes, then you have to live with that mistake in your vision, which is, I don't personally really like to do that, okay? So that seems like a little bit of an iffy procedure, but thousands and thousands of people have successfully gone through that procedure, but there have been mistakes. Anybody know anybody that has gone through a procedure or had a friend gone through a procedure that didn't work quite right? Everybody here doesn't, huh? Yeah. They were worse after LASIK. So that's too bad. So then they just went back to glasses? Yeah, just went back to glasses. I guess some of the other things are too, your night vision, no matter if it's a good correction or a bad correction, your night vision is not going to be the same either. It's going to look blurry. It might have little star patterns. Why is that? Well, take your glasses and maybe take a Brillo pad and put some scratches in your glasses, and so everything is kind of look hazy during the day, but at night you'll be able to see every light is going to look like a star. So light is going to have all these different light rays coming from different points at night, and it's really confusing to see. If your vision is just kind of gray, if it's not too gray, it's not such a big deal. But at night, if everything looks like a star, then it gets really confusing for your brain to figure out. Yeah, so night vision is definitely hindered. So I don't recommend people do a LASIK procedure just for cosmetic reasons, right? But if you need that for work, like if you were Sugar Ray Leonard, Muhammad Ali, right, a boxer, football player, you don't want to go out, right, and perform your sport with glasses on because you can't, then LASIK procedure is fantastic, right? Do the LASIK procedure and then you can earn $15 million every night or whatever it is. Then that's really money well spent. Okay. Maybe not so just for cosmetic reasons. Another good reason is if your vision is so poor to where you can't even find your glasses in the morning, right, then a LASIK procedure is going to change your life. Then it's a great application for that particular procedure. And the other thing is that I like to wear glasses. Because what do glasses do besides allow you to see properly? Yeah, they protect your eyes. They're like goggles to some extent, right? And so I don't know if you've ever built swing sets for your kids or rode motorcycles or any of that kind of stuff. It's good to be able to protect your eyes, right? Because the cornea is very delicate, right? Very delicate, easy to puncture. Anatomy, you learn some of these things. Oh, it's just sort of fun to talk about these, right? But don't forget, there's fluid inside the eye, Anybody remember the two different kinds of fluid? Like back over here, what kind of fluid is this? And this posterior compartment. Vitreous humor, not very runny. Different from the fluid that's in this anterior compartment in front of the iris and even behind the iris, but in front of the lens. What is this fluid? Aqueous humor, that's like water. That will flow, right? So if the cornea is perforated, well, which is a really bad thing because you have a lot of nerve endings in the cornea. And if you damage your cornea, I've been told that will give you the most exquisite sense of pain that you can ever experience. So it's never good to damage your cornea, good to wear glasses. But if the cornea is perforated and you're writhing in pain, that aqueous humor is going to drain out from this anterior chamber, which means there's nothing separating the cornea from the iris. There's nothing separating the iris from the lens. And all of these things are very sticky. And when they touch each other, they get stuck together. And no one has ever figured out a good way to unstick them. All right, so what could you tell me about the iris? Is it a big deal if it gets stuck to something? What is it doing all day long? It's changing shape all day long, right? And so now it can't change shape. So your vision is drastically distorted, right? When you go from inside to outside a building. All right, what about the lens? Is it moving? Yeah, it's moving all day long, depending on if you're looking close up or far away. But if it's glued to something else, then guess what? Can't change shape. So that is really a big deal, right? So never lose that aqueous humor. And if that ever happens to you, I don't really know of any kind of first aid to prevent that condition from happening. So you have to deal with it how? Prophylactically, wearing glasses or goggles. Eye protection is really, really important. Okay, so the organ for vision is the retina. And the retina is a highly metabolic organ, requires a lot of ATP, so that if you have problems making ATP, what's a good energy molecule for making ATP in your body? What's a good one? Yeah, mitochondria is an organelle. What do mitochondria really like to use to make ATP? What did we study in here in particular? We studied fatty acids, but fatty acids don't require glycolysis. What goes through glycolysis? Sugar, glucose, yeah. And do you know of a condition where glucose cannot enter a cell? It stays in your blood? Yeah, diabetes, right? So people with diabetes, eventually, if it's not controlled, their retina is going to die as a result of that because your retina requires so much energy. All right, so let's take a look at the retina. It has a number of different layers. All right, so here is the vitreous humor. This is where light is coming in before it hits the retina. And then I see some nerve fibers of what, like cranial nerve number one. And then here are some more nerve fibers. Oh, here's a nice fancy bipolar cell. We got some amacrine cells and some horizontal cells. And then finally, some receptor cells, okay, that are deep. So light has to pass through all these different neural layers before it gets to the receptor cells. That's always struck me as a little strange, right? But light can do that no problem. Now, are these receptor cells hair cells? They don't look like hair cells. All right. These are special kinds of receptor cells that are sensitive to light. Okay. And if they're straight like this, we call that a rod cell. If they have a tip on them, we call it a cone cell. The cone cell is actually quite a bit smaller than these rod cells, really not shown nicely on this diagram, but we have a different illustration probably on the next slide. But before I get to the next slide, right, these rods and cones have different functions. And you should be aware of the different functions. The cone cell, because it's small, gives you fine resolution. It can give you a lot of detail. So it can see really small things because it is a small cell. It captures light from just a small area. The other thing a cone cell is really good for is that you can see color. So cone cells are good for high resolution, fine detail, and color vision. The cone cell over here, since it's bigger, cannot give you high resolution. It gives you a kind of a blurry image. Not quite blurry, but not really the same kind of detail. And it gives you no color information whatsoever. It can only show you, only let you perceive shades of gray, black to white and gray. Right, so color vision due to cones, black-white vision due to rods. The advantage is, since this rod cell is bigger, it needs less light. in order for it to work, because it's capturing light from a bigger surface. So in dim light, the rod cells work. You can still see things. You just can't see the fine detail. And what else can't you see? Color, right? When dim light is available to you, then you just have black and white vision. All right, so what's the best vision? What's the best vision is provided by cone cells, right? And you have a bunch of extrinsic eye muscles, six of them located all around your eyes. It's moving your eyeball around so that when light enters your eye, it goes to one particular part of the retina and it gives you your best vision. And guess what kind of cell is in that area that those extrinsic eye muscles always focus light into? Has cones. Yeah. And that's called the fovea centralis. Probably you remember that from anatomy. Exclusively cone cells. Okay, and as the retina, as you move from that area peripherally out to the sides, then the cone cells kind of give way. There's less and less and less of them, and then you also have more and more rod cells. So your peripheral vision is good for black and white and for dim light. Your very central vision, right, has no rod cells, does not work for dim light at all. And maybe you're kind of aware of that. Maybe at night you went out and there are no clouds in the sky and you looked at some stars and you saw some stars and you look right at them and a particular star disappeared. Because that light from that star was going to the cones, they're not sensitive enough to see that star. But if you look to the side, guess what you see? The star reappears. If you haven't done that, go try that sometime when the sun goes down. Okay? Because you need peripheral vision to see dim light, that's where the cone cells are. And these are the two kinds of photoreceptor cells, and there are different kinds of cone cells. We won't get into that in this class. Okay, then the sclera. What can you tell me about the sclera here? Function of sclera, real quick. It's the toughest layer, right, that protects the eye, right? Tougher than an eggshell, kind of like shoe leather. The choroid layer, right here, contains blood vessels, right, that's deep inside the retina. So light usually doesn't get to the choroid layer. You can't have blood vessels in the retina because why can't you have blood vessels up over here? Even though these neurons need oxygen and nutrients, why can't you have a blood vessel here? If you have a blood vessel, then you don't have photoreceptor cells and you have a blind spot, right? Or you have a deficit in vision in that particular area. And there's a condition, well, it used to happen, right? It doesn't happen anymore. Okay, when a neonate, when a fetus was born, okay, prematurely, what would we do for somebody born prematurely and their lungs are not developed? Put them in an incubator. Incubator has a higher concentration of oxygen, so that relieves their pulmonary deficit a little bit, helps them to breathe a little bit easier. But in that high oxygen environment, oxygen can diffuse through the cornea, around the lens, through the vitreous humor, and diffuse into the retina right here. And when the retina has a high oxygen concentration, guess what happens to these blood vessels? That stimulates their growth. They grow up into this area to get oxygen, and when they grow up into the retina, what happens to the retina? It gets destroyed. It gets pushed apart, right? So those photoreceptors aren't there. So we call that retinopathy of prematurity. And that really doesn't happen anymore because we know it happens, and then a physician has to make a decision on what the oxygen concentration should be in that incubator, right? So it's a balance. We don't want to cause blindness in somebody, but we need to give them enough oxygen so that they don't die. So that can be a difficult decision sometimes. All right, so choroid has blood vessels. Here's a pigmented epithelium that is right up against the rod and cone cells. And the cone and rod cells are growing all the time, and the tips die off, and those remnants of the tips of rods and cone cells then are processed by the pigmented epithelium so it doesn't build up. The pigmented epithelium also prevent antibodies from the blood getting into the retina because there are some autoimmune diseases where a person's own immune system can attack the retina, and when it does, then they lose vision when that happens. All right, so this pigmented epithelium is important. Oh, and it says pigmented. What's a pigment? It is a chemical that can do what? It's a chemical that can absorb light, is what a pigment is, right? And we have natural pigments in our body to absorb light. We have them in our skin, protect us from sunlight. Here is one that's in the retina, and this absorbs light so that when light comes in, it doesn't bounce back off the deeper layers of the retina and then cause like sparkles or other kinds of aberrations in your vision. Okay. In some animals, this pigmented epithelium is very silvery, so light does bounce back out of it. Kind of acts like a mirror. Do you have any animals at home like that, and how would you notice? Maybe a cat at night, shine a flashlight at them, and if they're looking at the flashlight, what do their eyes look like? It doesn't even look red, because it will show some of the blood vessels here. It will look like they have two flashlights. You'll actually see light coming out of their eyes, right? Pretty spooky, because they have a special layer. Okay, so there is the retina once again. So these optic nerve fibers go to the brain. The amacrine cells and the horizontal cells right here help process information, visual information, before it even gets to the brain, because our vision is such an exquisite sense. Right? And we have action potentials in these amacrine cells and in the optic nerve cells right here, but we don't in bipolar cells, and we don't have action potentials in rod and cone cells. We have, what's the opposite of an action potential? Graded potential, right? So bipolar cells and these rods and cones here, we have just graded potentials, not action potentials. So here we have a couple of photoreceptor cells. You can see how thick a rod cell is and how thin a cone cell is. So that relates directly to what kind of acuity that provides us. And if we look at a cell, we can see that the deep region right here, we call the outer segment. And can you see something that almost looks like striation? I can see a lot of layers in the cell. These are what we call discs. Oh, maybe I want to do this. Hopefully you didn't get a sore neck. Okay, so we call those discs. Both rods and cone cells have discs, right? And these discs grow from the inner segment out to the tip, and then that pigmented epithelium deals with those discs and processes them so they don't build up. Right? And then we have the body of a cone and a rod cell, all right? And then we have a synaptic ending. What's the job of a synaptic ending or an axon terminus? Is to, for a chemical synapse, it releases neurotransmitter, right? And both rod and cone cells release neurotransmitter, and the amount is dependent on light conditions. So I'll talk about that in just a little bit. There are photopigments in the outer segment. There are chemicals that can absorb light, and then when those chemicals absorb light, it changes the electrical properties of these cells. It can cause hyperpolarization, for instance. So we need to look at how that happens. And I talked about this already. All right, so what are some of these things that can absorb light, and how does that relate to changing electrical properties of the cell? All right, so we got something called rhodopsin, and we're only going to talk about rod cells, not cone cells. All right, so black and white vision is due to a chemical called rhodopsin, and rhodopsin is a combination of a protein that we call opsin, right, and then something that almost looks like a vitamin, retinol. So here we have retinol, and I can see two different forms of retinol. I can see a curved form, and I can see a linear form. And this happens because of the arrangement of these double and single bonds between the carbons in this long carbon chain. All right, so if we have, can I see it on here? If we have hydrogen, well, it looks... Oh, here it is. Okay, at this location, right here, no, I can't point it out to you. Okay, if all the hydrogens are on one side of this chain, we call that cis. If they're on opposite sides, we call that trans. Right, so there's just a little rotation at one of these chemical bonds. And so the molecule really doesn't change its formula at all. It just goes from a cis to trans form, right? And it has to be in a cis form or this curved form to fit in the opsin protein,
And if it's in a transform, then it gets to be this linear. It changes shape. And if it changes shape, can it fit into that? Something you could consider this like the active side in opsin. What happens when you change the shape of this retinol molecule? You change the function. You change where it can fit in. And it changes shape when it absorbs light. Right? So when it absorbs light, it goes from this curved form. Right? As when it absorbs light, it goes into this linear form, and then it can't bind opsin, and it can actually be released from the opsin molecule. And this, then, is going to change the permeability of ions across the membrane. And if it changes the permeability of ions across the membrane, what does that do to membrane potential? So this change right here is going to change various gates in the membrane. What happens when you change the permeability? Like of sodium. Which way is sodium going to go? If you let it, now you allow it to move. It's going to go in, and it's going to cause depolarization, right? Or if you close a sodium channel, sodium can't go in, and that's going to cause hyperpolarization. All right, so this conformation change can change the, like the resting membrane potential of rod and cone cells. And we're only talking about rod cells. Okay, well, I think that's it for today. So I'm going to finish this lecture up as a video and then start talking about the endocrine system. So you got to look at that video a couple times and write down some questions, because these last couple slides can be really confusing. So maybe it's a good thing that it will be a video, because then you'll be able to see it over and over and over again until it makes sense. Okay, please sign the sign-in sheet. So what kind of physics did you learn today? Body in motion stays in motion. Body at rest stays at rest. So what's my advice to you? Get going. Stay in motion.